The question is, can the daily practice of asanas alone help one towards inner enlightenment and well-being? How long should a session of asanas last? Now, the first part. The daily practice of asanas alone will help towards, but won't bring about, inner enlightenment. If you are born with a gift as a pianist, well, let us say, well, you practice your scales and arpeggios, your cherny and all the rest of it, you see. You train your hands and your fingers, and you do other, you carry out other aspects of your training too. But they are all different aspects. Each one of them by itself will not produce your top-rate concert performance. See, they all have to go together. What is the purpose of the asanas? So to discipline the body that it does not interfere with the manner in which your mind and consciousness function throughout the day. That is the fundamental purpose of the asanas. So, they will help, but always realize the limits. How long should a session of asanas last? Well, again, just as some pianists need only 3 or 4 hours practice a day, others need 12 and 14. That rests with you and what your natural capacities, your interests, and above all, please, your good sense tells you what to do. You overdo anything. You know the good old English proverb, too much of a good thing, and it does you harm. Now the next question, it is difficult to see when the natural responses of the pleasure-pain feelings to events should be acted upon spontaneously and when they should be denied. Can you please guide us on this? The pleasure-pain mechanism of the body, the physical body as such, as I said in the talk, gives rise to its psychical, to their psychical counterpart in terms of I like, I don't like. And one wants more of what one likes, and one wants to be rid of what one dislikes. This raises up the conflict of the acceptance and rejection of whatever life presents to you. Where this conflict is concerned, there is no question of trying to decide whether one should act upon your reaction, upon your psychical reactions spontaneously, or whether you should deny it, because either will lead to bondage. You see, this is the binding element, not the pleasure-pain mechanism of the body as such. That is given by nature for self-preservation. But the reaction psychically, wanting to grasp or wanting to be rid of, produces conflict. And this is not favorable to being a yogi. What is required in the situation is to be completely observant, completely mindful of all the impulses which come to one, the stimuli which come to one, observe them as such, observe the reactions of the brain to those stimuli, and if your attentiveness is really whole and complete, and you are fully aware of the activity of your own conditioning, then you will know precisely what is the right thing, the best thing to do. Therefore, there is no question of denial or spontaneously responding. In other words, there is no indulgence, there is no suppression. Neither indulge nor resist. No lesser teacher than Jesus said, and he was one of the supreme yogis of the world, resist not evil. Understand it completely. And in the complete understanding here and now, as the evil takes place, whatever you do will be the right thing. It's a very tricky and a very difficult situation. Because you see, when one makes these spontaneous responses, one easily falls into the trap of self-indulgence. That is the great difficulty. And the more you indulge, the more you're in bondage. Similarly, that which you see is, which you intellectually see is really not good, and you fight against it, that also binds you. You see? And therefore, the spiritual reality, which is non-finite, cannot function through you freely. This is a very difficult problem. I know everybody in the world has to face it all the time. This is the next question. With reference to people, for example, monks, who go off and live as recluses in order to further their spiritual knowledge or knowledge of the self, can this in any way be seen as a selfish act? That is, because they are not sharing their knowledge with others. If one retreats from life and life's problems, one runs away from them by going to a monastery or living in a mountain cave, then obviously one is going to remain limited, not capable. At the same time, it must be clearly borne in mind that we are so constituted that we have the alternation of activity and rest. Therefore, we have to live in the world and deal with the world not on the world's terms, but in the light of our own yogic vision of truth, of the whole truth, of reality. You see? It is necessary also to go into seclusion, because the mind must have its source of refreshment. Just as the body in sleep, in dreamless slumber, gets recharged with life, with pure life energy, so the mind needs recharging. And therefore, your period, short or long, spent in a monastery or in seclusion, meditating, as you might call it, studying and so forth, is also a necessity if you are that sort of person. Find out what sort of person you are for yourself. Nobody else can really tell you, because your mind and heart is your own private sanctum into which no one can penetrate. Partly others can know you. But inwardly, you alone can know yourself. You may have deceptions, illusions about yourself, but you'll soon find out, because they'll hurt somewhere or other. And then you'll know, if you wish to know. But if you resist that knowing, then you will have more pinpricks invisibly. So both aspects are necessary. The quietness, the aloneness, as well as being in the world but not of the world. Here is a question addressed to Professor Mehta. I don't know who he is. I'm plain Mr. Mehta. Is there nothing divine or transcendent about differences in personality of human beings? Or is this just karma on the way to a higher uniform development? Personality is a difficult word. The person, the transcendent reality of the person, which is manifest through you, the psychophysical individual, is something which belongs to the context of the infinite, the immeasurable, the incomparable. There are no yardsticks to measure differences. You see, we talk about eternity and this, that and the other, but we really have no inner sensitivity of the real nature of those things. Where the infinite is concerned, how are you to measure anything? It just is not measurable. Personality is a word which we use with respect to the image of what you really are. An image. An image is a fixation, a mental fixation. It's a fossil. People try to live up to such and such an image and see what a mess they make of their lives. No living person remains unchanging. He's constantly changing. But if his change is in line with the trends of growth of the human being in him, then that change is the right sort of change which takes place. Now, when that change is going on, that which is divine, transcendent, is working itself through him. But if his change is arbitrary, is contrary to the trends of life, because he is not perceptive enough, and so on, then there is nothing divine or transcendent working through him there, excepting in an indirect way. Transcendence is a curious thing altogether. Inscrutable are the ways of the divine, we say, quite rightly, inscrutable. But don't cling to personality, this image. That image is a false thing. Let it go. Have nothing to do with it. Particularly if yoga means something to you. The person, the living person, You know what the word person means? You look at the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the first chapter, the fourth section, the first verse. In the beginning, there was only Atma, the absolute all, the spirit, looking around and seeing nothing other than itself. It said, I am. And then it goes on to say that formerly the Atma burnt up all evil-mindedness. Now the word for formerly is purva. The root, the Sanskrit root of the word burnt is ush. So they took, the Upanishadic teachers took pur out of purva, ush as such, and made the word purusha. And this is the meaning of the person, the individual manifestation of Atma. Purusha. So person is really a sacred word. It means the person in whom all evil-mindedness is utterly burnt out. He is the perfected Holy One. What has personality as we understand it in the world to do with that? Nothing at all. Our concept and our idea of personality is a miserable daub pretending to be a wonderful portrait of the living person. The second part, or is this just karma on the way to a higher uniform development? No, this is the marvel of the universe, of the whole cosmos. The one only, the absolute all, is also simultaneously the multitudinous many. That is how you and I are conscious of the cosmos, as the multitudinous many. We are not sufficiently conscious of the unity of the whole, which contains this multitudinous variety. That's the marvel, the wonder of creation. You see? So, it is not a question of karma on the way to a higher uniform development in the sense of a characterless development. Where development is concerned, there are characteristics, there are differences which bring out countless millions of different facets of the beauty and the marvel of this primordial creative energy. So you have differences in the sameness. We talked about the equalizing wisdom through the transformation of our feelings through perfect love and wisdom. That equalizing wisdom. It doesn't mean that it's like so many millions of nuts and bolts turned out of the factory. Not at all. Each one is absolutely unique and wonderful. There's no one like you in the world. Each one of you. No one. And that uniqueness is the thing that comes to fruition and flower through action, karma in the creative sense. These questions always indicate how our own minds work. Here's another question. Is there any danger in meditating alone, that is, without the guidance of a teacher? When I was born, who taught me to suckle my mother's breasts? It just happened, didn't it? And once I got a good thwack on the back, after I was born, I started breathing. And who guided me from birth onwards where breathing was concerned? Who guides my digestive process, or the streaming of my blood, or the beating of my heart? Others can help me if I'm making mistakes in the process of breathing, for instance. Can give me hints. But teaching, no. Consider this point. Each one of us is a learner, a disciple. We undertake a discipline. Discipulus, a disciple. Each one of us can learn. And learning means to grow happily from within. It's your own life energy coming out which makes you learn. If in communicating with you, you inspire me in such a manner that I learn, then I have conferred teacherhood upon you. You can't teach me. I can't teach you. But each one of us can learn, and in the act of learning, confer teacherhood upon the person or the event or whatever it is that enabled us to learn and grow happily. Now, if you look at it that way, you will see that where meditation is concerned, all these guidances by teachers, they have their place, but they have very great limitations too. Actually, the teacher, so-called, conditions you. You can teach a particular skill. This is the difference between knowledge, which is a mechanical thing, and wisdom, which is a living thing. A skill can be handed over. Do this, do that, do the other, and lo and behold, such and such could be the result. You see? Knowledge can be handed over. Now, meditation doesn't belong to the category, to the context of knowledge. It belongs to the category of the living process, the growing process of your own mind and heart and your whole being. You meditate. No one can teach you to meditate, just as nobody teaches you how to breathe or how to eat. You just chew your food, you swallow it, you digest it, and it just happens, just goes on by itself. Now, what is the real meaning of the meditative state? What is its most distinctive characteristic? The isolating consciousness of myself as a separate subject is not present. It's not I who am meditating. There is only meditating or meditation going on. The Unio Mystica, the Samadhi, which means the supreme togetherness, is a fact which is no longer interfered with by my separative self-consciousness, that I am doing this. When that I consciousness is out and the attentiveness is whole and complete, it is one with the omniscience of the divine. It is the chit in the sat chit ananda of Brahman. You see? Therefore you'll see that meditation or samadhi is not something which can be attained as a particular separate goal in itself. Its character is universal, infinite, immeasurable. And in that is its wholeness, its holiness, its totality. Can any teacher teach you that? You, by virtue of your own psychical purification, by your own intellectual freedom from all the mental conditioning, the whole heap of concepts and fixed beliefs and ideas and so forth, you are free of all that, completely free. Then you will find that when you pay attention to anything, you are experiencing it in a transcendent manner. You are experiencing it as the separate person, the separate object as such, within its own finite context of the manifested world, and at the same time you are experiencing it in its complete interrelationship with totality. You know, you have to experience this. I mean, whatever I may say, if I succeed in helping you, it is only because what I am saying is less misleading than what somebody else has said. That is all one can do, to be less misleading. Don't think for a moment anyone can tell you the truth. No one can. So too, this meditation, the what I have called in this book, the timeless conjugation, because it's a creative state. It's a timeless conjugation, you see, and it's permanent with you. Whether you're cooking, washing up, whether you're running, at how fast can you run? 10 miles an hour? Whether you're running at top speed in order to catch that bus which is trying to leave you behind, you are in the meditative state. You are unself-conscious. Unself-conscious, not unconscious. You see? So, by all means, meet others, ask questions, find out, see what they say, see what they suggest, experiment. But your meditating, your actual meditating, will always come out of you yourself. No other way. You can't love by proxy. Meditating is an act of unifying. Yoga is the act of unifying. You can't do it by proxy. You can't get an agent to do it for you. See? So beware of self-professed teachers of this, that and the other. You confer teacherhood by your act of learning. Could one associate, the next question, could one associate a constant state of meditation with a constant state of samadhi? Yes, indeed. Samadhi is a constant state. It is not conditioned by time and space. It's the manner in which you are aware of existence. Look, take your own body. If you take your own body as representing the whole world, you are conscious of your body all the time, in some degree or other. Your living body is constantly associated with a living, functioning body consciousness. You see? So, if you think in terms of a supreme creative power which has produced the entire cosmos, that supreme creative power is conscious of the total cosmos all the time. You see? There is no break in that awareness. And Samadhi means precisely that kind of consciousness. What spoils Samadhi, the supreme togetherness, is the intrusion of a separate selfness. If the separate self intrudes, then there are two instead of one. These are very deep things and they are difficult things. This is one of the miracles of the whole cosmos. The one is the many, and the many are the one. The interrelationship is complete between this countless variety of apparently separate things. And when these things are no longer mere intellectual ideas and giving one intellectual pleasure and so forth, but have really become something as a matter of course. Of course it is so. You know it is so. Just like a child, if you ask that child, what is that flower? And he tells you it's a rose. And you tell, yes, he tells you it's a rose. And if you ask him, what is a rose? He'll turn around and frown at you perhaps and say, a rose is a rose. The absolutiveness of it. See, that's that sense of absoluteness, of transcendence, which we all have, but which we suppress, or which gets suppressed because of our somewhat faulty upbringing and still more faulty education. Now, this question, man and cosmos in bondage as opposed to spirit unafflicted. Man within the cosmos or cosmic man is a generally used term. How does cosmos fit into these two conceptions? Look, be very careful. The first part, I think, is not completely perfect, not perfectly worded. Man and cosmos in bondage as opposed to spirit unafflicted. Man and cosmos in bondage are not opposed to the unafflicted spirit. I use the word subsumed, you may recall. Eternity, immortality, the primordial creative energy, transcendence, any such word, you see, subsumes everything else within itself. We being conscious in the manner that we are conscious, due fundamentally to the way nature has constituted us, are not aware of the fact that the profounder dimension of being and consciousness, which is the infinite, the eternal and the immortal, completely holds all this within itself. We see the parts that are held within the totality. And we, because our vision is limited, see them sometimes as conflicting, sometimes as cooperating, and so forth. In the old days, when people believed that the earth was flat, and they said that the north is in that direction, and the south is in this direction, and they believed that if you went forever, if you wanted to go north, you just went forever and ever in that direction, and if you went south, you went ever and ever in that direction, and that the two were irreconcilable opposites. Now, having discovered that the earth is a globe, the north and south poles are not irreconcilable opposites, they are polar complementaries. Now, in the same way, man and cosmos, afflicted, are not in opposition to spirit unafflicted, but are contained within that. Supposing you were eternal God, you would not see it as an opposition or anything like that. It would all be part and parcel of one whole. It is you and I who are conscious in this limited manner who see things this way. Now, man within the cosmos or cosmic man is a generally used term. I don't quite understand in which sense you mean cosmic man. See, in the great scriptures of the world, in the book of Genesis, for instance, in the Trismegistic writings, in the Upanishadic writings, in the Zarathustrian teachings, everywhere you find man, when it is said that God, the Father God, or as in the Trismegistic writings, God, All Father Mind created man. That man, in that context, does not stand for this psychophysical organism. It stands for the primordial archetypal concept, what is referred to as the thought in the mind of God. Now, what sort of a mind have you or I, or rather, what is our conception of mind? But can we apply that to the transcendent? We use this language analogically. That is why I talked about intellectual projections. We throw out God in our own image and in our own likeness. You see? So, cosmic man refers in some curious way to this primordial, how shall I put it, mental creation, not to the biological creation of separate men and women. And that cosmic man, in many of these old teachings, is identified with the whole cosmos. That the whole cosmos came out of man. And there's a good reason for that idea. Simply because the word man, from its Sanskrit root, man, means ultimately to create. It doesn't merely mean to think, which is the dictionary meaning of the root man. Our word man, our word mind is derived from that. But this is the divine mind at work, which creates man, the thinker in the divine sense, which is unpicturable. But you can experience it in the deep states of meditation, when the intellect is at peace, and when the senses are all perfectly stilled and calm, then from the ocean depths of the universal consciousness, there comes enlightenment. And manas, your mind and my mind as such, is able to thrill to it. And then all the analytical activity of the other aspects of our psyche and mind come into play and produce lots and lots of words. Here is the last one. You said that the cosmos itself was involved in suffering. It seems that certain states of consciousness and also of physical suffering and well-being are related to the expression of the cosmos through us, as in astrology and as in karma, the action of creation. How can these cosmic conditions and factors be transformed? Is liberation freedom from that, or freedom within that? Well, actually, you've answered your own question. Liberation is freedom within that, not from that. You see, freedom belongs to the context of the transcendent, not of the particular, not restricted to the particular. That is true freedom. And that spells the freedom of the spirit. And it is there in totality within that, when you wake up to that, that there is freedom in the context of our everyday life, where we say that we are in bondage.